Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I'm so happy to welcome back returning guest, Chris Shelton, ex-Scientologist, not just ex-Scientologist, but actually an ex-Sea Org member, which is a big deal. But if you don't know what that means, I'm sure Chris will enlighten us as to what Sea Org means, what that's all about. More importantly, I guess you are the host also of the Sensibly Speaking podcast, and I'm really interested to find out why you do what you do. So welcome back, Chris, to the show.
Awesome, man. Thanks for having me. It's always a good time.
It is, and we just had a recording on your show not long ago. We talked about, well, dominion theology and all this other kind of stuff, so I'm glad that you're returning the favor and coming in and talking about your kind of area of expertise, which is, of course, Scientology. I'm curious, though, to find out, why didn't you just walk away? You left Scientology. You remember, I think you said, what, 17 years, something like that?
Well, I was 17 years in the Sea organization, and I was 27 years altogether in, you know, really being a Scientologist. And factually, I'd been around it for 38 years.
Were you born into it, basically?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
my parents got involved when I was four.
Right. You had little choice. So that's one thing we've agreed in the past. We've talked about that we were both kind of born into our religions. I, of course, come out of evangelical fundamentalist Christianity, and we've compared notes. In fact, we did a whole episode not long ago on the differences, or maybe we should say the similarities, between fundamentalist Christianity and Scientology, looking at Robert Lifton's eight sort of markers of cults, and that was really a fascinating discussion, I think. But why do you do what you do? Why didn't you just walk away after all your life and just say, you know what, that was a chapter, I'm done now, I'm an ex-Scientologist, and I'm going to move on? Why are you doing this podcast?
Well, I'm gonna maybe surprise you. I don't know, or the audience, but I'm gonna say it's Scientology's fault.
Okay.
And the reason, because you know, they made me who I am, right? And what I mean is,
they made that, you the monster that you are.
Well, kind of. Okay, here was the trajectory of my life, right? I mean, if you want the full answer to this question, I joined Scientology when I'm 15, right? I start doing classes and stuff. 17 years old, I just get out of high school. I'm this nerdy, geeky little kid. And I have aspirations of becoming a writer. I love Stephen King. I love fantasy. I love sci-fi. I have, at this point in my life, 17 years old, I have read thousands of books. I'm a voracious reader. And I want to write fiction stories. I want to write sci-fi, fantasy, horror, dark fantasy, whatever you want to call it. I wanted to get into all that. And I was going to pursue a trajectory of teaching. I was going to be an English teacher because I've always had a knack for language and that kind of thing. I think that's why I was such a voracious reader, and I think these two things fed each other. And Scientology in its own way, and my upbringing in its own way, contributed to that, because I was always in dictionaries. I was always looking up words, understanding the nuances of words, and looking in encyclopedias, and just, you know, I was hungry for knowledge. But what Scientology did, and this is actually kind of important, is they recruited me into Scientology staff, to working at the Santa Barbara Church of Scientology, where this is where I started. And at that level, they need to convince you, or at least the way they went in on me, is they needed to convince me that this was the single most important thing in the world to do. It had to be more important than college, more important than my career trajectory that I could sort of envision. And so what they put there to take that place of that and instill in me a new purpose for my life was the purpose to save the world. And that's a very generic, you know, sort of thing. Well, it had a lot of specifics to it. There was a lot to that deal that from L. Ron Hubbard's writings, from his lectures, things they were showing me. This went on, by the way, this recruitment conversation or interview went on for days. This wasn't just a one-time sit down and show me a few things and say, hey, you want to do this? This was a high-pressure sit down. We're going to talk now. Hours and hours of going over L. Ron Hubbard's writings, going over stories of the organization, Santa Barbara, the history of the church, the staff there, how hard they worked, all of the staff coming up one at a time and telling me their story and why I should be part of it, why I should be part of staff at Santa Barbara and how much I could contribute to it and how important I was to the big picture, personally, me, Chris Shelton, not just anybody whose shoulder could go to the wheel, but me. They needed me to be on board. The love bombing, all this, all the phraseology that we use. Yeah. Oh yeah, all this stuff, right? I mean, they were lying to me like crazy, but and some of the lies they knew about, and many of them they didn't. I mean, they were also feeding me all the stuff that they had been fed over all those years. I don't look back on this as a horrible, you know, like how could they sort of thing in my life.
It wasn't a con job necessarily.
No, they were honestly thinking that they were that they were saving the world. And they wanted my help, right? And they were going to tell me the things that they thought were going to work to convince me to make this massive, huge paradigm shift in my entire life. How this answers your question is because obviously I bought into it hook, line, and sinker. I believed everything they told me as truth. L. Ron Hubbard had written that the world only has 5 years to go, right? We're on a time clock here. And he had written it. Here's what's so funny is he had written it in 1969 or 1970 or something. And then, of course, out comes the, you know, the logic of, well, the only reason the world didn't implode after 5 years is because we were around, right? And right, we were doing the work necessary. That's right, to stave it off. But disaster looms at any moment and, you know, and everything could fall apart. And look at the, you know, we went from the oil crisis to the population crisis to, you know, the religion crisis to the satanic panic to all this stuff. I mean, this was, we were right in the middle of it when I was being recruited in 1987. This is when all this was going down, right? So we're in the middle of, you know, all of that political, religio-cultural nonsense. And the 80s looked like a pretty good time from my point of view as a high school student. I thought I had a pretty bright future. No, the world's going to hell. And if I don't step up and do something about it, the world, the future is not bright at all. And we're in fact all going to die a horrible, painful, and awful death. So that put me on this new path, which I went all in on with all of my gusto and all of my belief. And that is what drove me for the next 25 years, right? Because at this point, I've been in Scientology for 2 years, officially doing services, doing their Purif detox program, doing the auditing, doing these things as a public, you know, person finishing high school. Now I'm going to join the group and I'm going to go all in. So I was dedicated. I was a true believer. Exactly as described in books and cults and Robert Lifton and all of that. So I was, and I really was all in. 8 years as a staff member in Santa Barbara, I then doubled down and I joined the Sea Org. And the Sea Org is the core group of Scientology. It's about 4,000 people around the world all together. That's the Sea Org. It's the clergy. It's the monastic order that keeps Scientology functioning and together. And that's about the easiest analogies I can give you for it. It's a paramilitary, you know, yes sir, no sir, ranks and ratings.
Naval uniforms and everything.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So I entered that lifestyle and that was going truly all in. Those are the guys, if you've heard out there about this billion-year contract, right? The Scientologists sign a billion-year contract. That's crazy. That's the Sea Org.
Did you sign one?
That's where that happens. I did, yes.
You got a few years left to go, Chris. You better get back
there. You know, so 25 years, I worked my ass off for this organization. I endure a whole lot of physical, psychological abuse, blah, blah, blah. Then I come out in 2012. Well, you don't do something for 25 years on this trajectory, on this mm-hmm. vector you've been launched on, that Scientology launched me on, right? I didn't choose this path. It presented itself. And I was hard sold on how this was a necessity. This wasn't a choice. This was something I had to do in order to change conditions in the world. Otherwise, there wasn't going to be any future. Well, what? All that's supposed to just go away the second you walk out or the second you realize that Hubbard wasn't telling the truth? No, of course not.
Yeah, you don't just snap your fingers and it all just goes away. That you spent your entire life serving this organization.
That's right. And serving,
ascribing to these ideologies and everything.
Exactly. I actually felt for most of that time that I was serving mankind. I didn't look at myself as just a Sea Org member who was working his guts out for 50 hours a week and who cares. I thought I was really doing something for mankind as a whole. And I took that shit seriously. So when I left, it didn't all just go away. But what came in, of course, when I learned about, you know, all of this was the betrayal, the intense sense mm-hmm. of betrayal and anger. And there are no other words. I really should go get it. I keep saying this because I haven't, you know, just gone and busted open a thesaurus. But there's, you know, somehow there must be some word that encapsulates this. But I haven't found it yet other than to just say, imagine the most intense level of betrayal you could possibly feel. And then times it by 100, and that's where I was at, right? Like, my whole life, 25 years, gone. They're never coming mm-hmm. back.
Never
my
getting life it back.
My life half over, and it's not coming back. I was 42 years old when this all came down, right? Yeah,
what do you have to show for it?
Exactly, nothing. So I was a little pissed. But I also had formed a whole lot of habits, and my whole life was now all about serving other people. And I don't mean serving in a subservient sense, but I mean in putting other people's interests first,
mm-hmm.
right? That was very, very much at the heart and soul of who I had now become after all these years. And that in and of itself is not inherently a bad thing. It's what you do with it that determines whether something is good or bad. Mm-hmm. And in my case, I then took this anger and this bottled up rage that was inside me now. We're now talking about me around, you know, early to mid 2012 is I'd gotten, 2013. I'd gotten out of the Sea Org by 2012. Got on the internet, you know, found out it was all bullshit, just become this rage monster, but I had to suppress it all because my entire life was surrounded by Scientologists. Still, even after leaving the Sea Org, I only knew socially Scientologists.
That was your bubble, your community.
Yeah. So I then felt, finally getting to the exact answer to your question, I felt like I needed to do something much, much more than just walk away. I couldn't just walk away. I needed to talk about this. And at first I talked anonymously, tried to not let it be known that it was me, you know, mm-hmm. spewing all this stuff about Scientology on internet forums and chat rooms and stuff. But, you know, Scientology tracks that stuff and they figured out who I was and they busted me. And then I got officially kicked out of the church. And then it was all the chains were off. The monkey was off my back. At that point, I could have turned and walked away. I had a job. I had a life forming in Minnesota. I had friends. I was in the skeptic community at this point. I could have just said, fuck it, and turned around and walked away. It never even dawned on me to do that. And like not even once did it even occur to me that I was just going to walk away. I was determined to get the word out about this because I can't tell you other than explaining my backstory that way and what Scientology did to instill that purpose of saving and helping people, which I did not have before. I point that out because as a 17-year-old high school graduate, saving the world was not on my mind.
Yeah. You were going to be a writer and be the next Stephen King.
That's right. That's what was on my mind, right? Now, fantasy or not, delusional or not, that was my goal, right? Stephen King has inspired a whole lot of people to write. Sure, I was one of them.
Yeah, same with me.
Yeah, and I was a writer. I wrote stories. This wasn't just a total fantasy. I actually had advanced in school because of my writing skills. I was a good writer, so I could write, and I had imagination. So I really thought I had a shot. All of that completely subsumed by Scientology, right? Taken over by that and this new purpose instilled. So after 25 years of that, it didn't even occur to me, oh, I'm going to now just take this Scientology experience, throw it in a box and never think about it again. I also felt, I think I can say that that was a motivating factor. And I think the other thing was a little bit, it wasn't as much of a factor for me personally as it might have been for other people, but I also definitely felt a sense of obligation because I had screwed some people over those 25 years. I did some wrong things and some bad things. I convinced people to spend money they shouldn't have spent. I told lies about joining the Sea Org, joining Scientology, knowing lies. Like I was misrepresenting the truth because I was under such pressure, like all the Scientologists are, to produce the goods and, you know, the end justifies the means kind of mentality. So I wanted to also maybe make up for some of that too. And then the third motivating factor was that it was catharsis for me. And that was probably the thing that drove me more than anything at the very beginning was it just felt right. It just felt like I needed to get this off my chest and people needed to know what was actually going on. We didn't yet have the Going Clear documentary. That was a year or two away. We didn't yet have Leah Remini in the aftermath. That was still a year or two away. So I was in this world where Anonymous had come out and had blown up Scientology back in 2007. People knew it was dangerous. They knew it was not just some kooky little cult. The abuses were being talked about. There were blogs. There were some videos. Enough that I felt like I was joining into this community. It wasn't just me, the Lone Ranger. And I thought, well, I've got knowledge, fresh knowledge, right off the boat knowledge that I can give to people about what's going on in this group and some of its schemes and plans. So let's go for it. And that was how it all started and why I started and why it is that all these years, and it's been about 6 or 7 years now, why I've never really thought about doing anything else. It's never occurred to me, okay, I'm done. Time to go do something else now.
Go back to fantasy writer.
That's right. Maybe at some point in the future. But today is not that day.
L. Ron Hubbard was a sci-fi, you know, he wrote westerns and all sorts, didn't
that's
he?
Right. That's
you
could right.
be the next L. Ron Hubbard.
Oh, God, shut up. Shut your mouth. I'm already a better writer than L. Ron Hubbard, I'll say that. That guy's Pulp Fiction was atrocious.
Pulp Fiction. There's so many things that come up when I listen to your story because I think, okay, you and I have so much in common. Growing up, the only difference was I was in fundamentalist Christianity, you were in Scientology, but yet everything you just described as far as getting involved in it and wanting to save the world, because I know Robert Lifton talks about this. He says that that's one of the big selling points of cults and groups with undue influence is that they convince people that they're going to become part of something that's bigger than themselves. So saving the world, that's about as big as it gets. You're not just you're a tiny cog in this machine, but you're an important cog. We need you, as you say. Everything you said, and I remember you said this in our last podcast, you said that if you strip away the ideology behind all these cults and groups, the psychology is virtually the same. And I've used that line many, many times in other podcasts. And it seems to me that you could replace everything that you just said, instead of Scientology doctrine, you could replace that with fundamentalist Christianity, you know, and plug those pieces in. And everything you just described pretty much describes my life as well. Because I was a voracious reader like you. I love to write as well. I wanted to be involved in something. I wanted to be a teacher. You know, and so me doing my podcast is a very similar motivation to yours, where I never really thought of not doing something to, you know, get the word out there and help people who are coming out of, in my case, evangelical Christianity. But now I've broadened out and met people like you and all sorts of other people, and we found that we have a lot in common. an amazing amount in common. That's what's so shocking, I guess, that's really caught me off guard when I started talking to people like yourself, how much we have in common in terms of the Reconstruction and all the stuff that went on during the time we were in that religion. Very interesting.
Isn't it, though? Isn't it? Especially, mm-hmm. I'll never forget, there have been some milestones along the way of this catharsis slash recovery, you know, slash exposing the abuses process that you and I are engaged in. And I wonder, you know, if some of those milestones might not be similar as well. You know, the decision to start speaking out, the realization that you have been involved in something that could very credibly be called a cult or a destructive cult. Sure, you can use other words, and you know, for some people those are trigger words or whatever, but I don't really care. For me, they fit exactly, and that's why I keep using them. But also, maybe that point, do you remember when you realized it wasn't just your group anymore? Like you saw, oh, that's wait it. A second.
Hang on a minute.
It's like this light bulb moment. Oh my God, it's not just L. Ron Hubbard who was doing this.
Yeah. Yeah,
Jim Jones did the same thing, right? You know, Joel Osteen's doing the same thing, right? Joseph Smith did the exact same thing.
David Koresh, Charles Manson. Yeah, you can just go down the list of
that's right. Keith Renier, whatever, right? Like all Nexium. These guys, they are all doing the same basic things, and that
same
was
playbook, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the way to say it.
Yes, that's right.
They have a very
cult playbook.
Yeah, and it's not a very big playbook, but it fucking works. That's the whole thing. It works, and they know it works, and so they try it, and it works, and they keep doing it. That's the amazing thing. Now, you said destructive cult. That's one thing I wanted to zero back on, because we know Scientology, the Church of Scientology, officially a tax-exempt organization. We've all seen probably the famous, there's that footage of David Miscavige at this huge event when Scientology won its tax-exempt status from the IRS, and he said, the war is over. We have won. We are now officially a tax-exempt organization. If you call a Scientologist and you say, or you tell a Scientologist, you're a member of a cult, you're going to get a lot of pushback. But is it a cult, and specifically, is it a destructive cult? And if it's a destructive cult, what makes it destructive?
Absolutely. There's almost a checklist. It's not an exact diagnostic tool. It's a generalized list of characteristics that you can apply to any group. And if a group winds up in the majority of these characteristics, then you're probably looking at a problematic or even cult-like or destructive cult group, right? There's a spectrum to this. It's not a black and white thing. It's not like, okay, it's almost a cult. Oh, it's a cult. You know, it's a gray, you know, you move in and every
gradations.
Group has, yeah.
And before that, they were fine.
That's right.
And now they're a cult.
That's right. Well, I have to stress this because people, you know, people tend to make to reduce, you know, get reductionist or overly simplify these things. And I want to stress that, you know, when you're laying this template over a group, you have to evaluate that group at this time in this place. You know, you have to be pretty precise about it. This is why I reject language like, you know, the Catholics are all part of a cult or all Christians are in a cult or something. Or, you know, it's just not true. That's not how it works. So you take. You take a group and you look at these characteristics. These were put together by Doctors Janja Lalic and Michael Angioni. And these are both people who have worked for the International Cultic Studies Association. Michael's still the president. Janja Lalic has been doing this for decades. She's, you know, sociologist. And they put this checklist together, which I came across early on in my searching or in my research on all of this. And I've just kind of glommed onto it as the most useful tool I've had to do this evaluation. And what you're looking at is, does a group tend to, not again, it doesn't have to do these things, but does it tend in these directions of
black and white?
Yeah, black and white thinking, right? Does it inculcate us versus them thinking? Not just does that happen, but does the group actively make that happen through its dogma, through its preachings, through its writings, through the leaders' speakings, right? Videos, whatever. Is the leader unduly interested in power, influence, sex, money? right? The four horsemen of awfulness, right? Is there a preoccupation with money on the part of the group? Again, every group needs some money to get by. It's not just, are they making money, but is there this kind of bizarre preoccupation with it? Do you have practices, rituals, or methodologies that create trance states or altered states of existence in the people's, in the followers' minds that make them or could put them in states where they are more suggestible, where they're more, you know, willing or compliant to do what the leader wants them to do through these methods. You know, you do trance induction, you do chanting, you do staring at walls, right? This kind of stuff. It puts people in altered states of mind when you do this for hours or even days at a time. And this is the practice that some of these guys get up to.
Right. So they're susceptible to mind control and indoctrination.
That's mystical, right.
What Lifton might call mystical manipulation. Is that kind of part of what we're talking about? Yeah,
exactly,
you put into context a milieu control, and it seems spontaneous, it seems free-flowing, but it's actually controlled and contrived, and you're but a pawn in this bigger game, as it were. We are just going to take a super short break here. I hope you're enjoying this chat with myself and Chris Shelton. I'm glad that he's been able to come back on the show. I felt kind of bad, actually, because I was on his show, the Sensibly Speaking podcast, for several episodes, and I kept saying to him, we've got to do an episode specifically on Scientology, and I'm glad that we're able to take a little bit of a deeper dive in this episode into really the psychology behind Scientology and look at how it relates to other cults. And of course, Chris and I have done a lot of work on his show, especially on comparing how cults work and my experiences coming out of evangelical fundamentalist Christianity and how that relates to his experiences in Scientology. I just wanted to let you know what's coming up in the next couple of weeks here on the show. I've got Julie Ingersoll coming up in the next episode. As you know, I've been doing a lot of work on Dominion theology. One of the major streams of Dominion theology is what they call Christian Reconstructionism. I've talked a little bit about this. You've heard me mention the name R.J. Rushdoony. He was one of the major kind of godfathers, you could say, of Christian Reconstructionism. And what is so great about talking to Julie is that she's an expert in this field. In fact, she wrote a very helpful book on this subject called Building God's Kingdom Inside the World of Christian Reconstructionism. And what I wanted to do with Julie was focus on two kind of key areas. First of all, the subject of how Christian Reconstructionism has fed into Christian education and specifically Christian homeschooling. And then second, also we talk about the influence of Christian Reconstructionism on the Christian right or the politicization of evangelicalism, something that Dominion theology is really a main sort of mover and shaker. So that's coming up in the next episode of Bind Shift Podcast. Then I've got a chat with Dan Cope of the You Have Permission podcast. This is a complete sort of detour from talking about Christian Reconstructionism and Dominion theology, but it's really fascinating because Dan is really a progressive Christian, and we have a really good discussion, kind of comparing notes, me as an ex-evangelical, him still as a Christian, but really a progressive one. And in fact, I've been listening to his show. He's been doing a series called End Times Anxiety, which I really resonate with, coming out of the evangelical movement. I've done episodes on that movie that struck fear into an entire generation of kids in church, A Thief in the Night. So it's actually been really good to listen to those episodes that Dan's been doing and hearing the stories of other people who had similar experiences to mine, and maybe you will resonate with that as well. So I'd encourage you to check out his series on End Times Anxiety. Anyway, all that said, I really think you're going to enjoy that chat with me and Dan. Also, I am talking to Dr. Marlene Winnell. She's the one who really founded this notion of religious trauma syndrome. I guess you could say she coined that phrase. She's written a ton of stuff on it. I'm going to be talking to her, specifically focusing on RTS and what it's all about from her point of view as an expert in the field. In fact, speaking of religious trauma, don't forget that my friend Jana Selby, she's going to be putting on the conference on religious trauma, and that's going to be in Vancouver, BC in April of this year. You can look that up on court2020.com. And in fact, speaking of which, if you're a supporter of this show on Patreon, you are eligible for a discount for the Court 2020 conference. This is something you're not going to want to miss. As a matter of fact, Dr. Marlene Winnell, she's going to be one of the speakers there, along with Janja Lalić, Dr. Janja Lalić, who was on the show just a couple of months ago. So her, along with Marlene Winnell and a bunch of other speakers and authors, are going to be talking about this very important subject of religious trauma. So this is something that's coming up, as I say, in April in Vancouver, BC. So there's a lot of stuff coming up on this show. I'm working on a massive project I'm super excited about. This is another thing that's in the works. I've written an article on Medium exploring this concept of first or second generation people. In other words, people who entered a cult or religion at some point in their life and then left, or people who were born into it, what we call second generation, although it could be even third or fourth or fifth generation, but people who were born into it. I've been doing a lot of research on this and writing on it, and this has led me to talk to a lot of people who were either born into a cult or religion or who entered it later in life. And so we're going to be doing a couple of episodes. I'm not sure how many we're going to do. Depends on how much response. I'm already starting to get responses coming back in from people, but they are recording their stories. I've got a questionnaire that they can work through, talking about their experiences as a first or second generation cultist or religious member who walked away and left it all behind, and then the process of reconstructing or recovering the identity that was either lost, or maybe they never had one in the first place. The only identity that they may have had was the religious one. And so this is an absolutely fascinating project. I am super excited to be getting into that. In fact, a lot of the people in our closed Mindshift podcast Facebook group are participating in this. This is something that you get as a reward for being a Patreon supporter of the show. And in fact, I wanted to give a shout out to Sherry Todd, who is the latest $5 a month Patreon supporter. Thank you, Sherry. And in fact, her gift for being a supporter is in the mail now, along with some other people. A nice little gift from North Wales, something you can only get here. If you're a $10 a month supporter, you get a free Mindshift podcast t-shirt. So just some kind of cool rewards. You also get early access to the shows on Wednesdays. You don't have to wait till Friday. And you also get access to the closed Mindshift Podcast Facebook group. And as I say, I'm using a lot of people in that group. I'm tapping them as resources for this upcoming series on first and second generation cultists or controlling religion members, people who joined it and then walked away, or like me, who were born into it. So there's a lot of really cool stuff coming up in the next few weeks and months. Anyway, I don't want to keep you too long. I've probably been talking too much. Let's jump back into the conversation between myself and Chris Shelton as we continue to explore the psychology of Scientology. So yeah, exactly. You're put in an altered state. You're susceptible to indoctrination. This is hallmark.
Exactly, and a real big one, and this is really important, and probably one of the most common denominators from one of these groups to the next is sacred truths, right? Is that you have a line into the truth with a capital T, right? Is the truth.
Sacred and science, yeah.
That's right. Right. Yeah. L. Ron Hubbard claimed over and over and over again that Scientology is the only, and only workable system that man has ever invented or discovered that will lead to a general and guaranteed improvement in anybody who practices it honestly and knowingly, right? So you get these little, you know, built-in sort of baked-in conditionals that mm-hmm. automatically will set up the thought stopping if it doesn't work on somebody. Oh, they weren't honest. Oh, they didn't really mean it. Oh, they weren't faithful enough, right? Or whatever. It's all built-in, baked-in.
Yeah. We've heard it in the church, yeah.
That's right. But this business of having the truth is really, really important. It's a key fundamental point of every one of these groups, is every one of them think they have some line into this sacred knowledge that you need. You don't have it as a non-member. You need it as a member. And by getting it, you will rise to this new amazing state of awareness.
Well, and isn't usually the cult leader, he himself, usually it's a man, is that messianic figure in so many cases. Like you just ran down the list of classic cult leaders from the past. Every one of them served in a way as that messianic, which L. Ron Hubbard too, didn't he? He had the inside line to mental health through Dianetics and all the rest of it. You needed that to get to wherever he promised you could go. So yeah, I can see how it would feed into that mentality.
Exactly. And let me then sort of wrap up this list by saying that now, after having gone through all that, what I've come to realize, or how I've described it and have been agreed with by others in the cult community, is that, or, you know, the ex-cult community, I should say, and this includes specialists like, you know, psychologists, doctors, sociologists, etc., is basically at its heart, at the core of this thing, and what you're really looking at when you're looking at a destructive cult, is you're looking at a deceptive, abusive relationship that involves, you know, it's got three elements. It's got authoritarian control, extremist belief, and separatism. It separates you from
isolation.
Connections. That's right. Isolates you. That's mm-hmm. right. And that's true whether it's a group of two where you're just in a narcissistic relationship with somebody, which is exactly like a little mini cult, all the way up to 7 million people in the Jehovah's Witnesses, right? You've got the same things going on, the same mechanisms at play. But basically, if you were going to reduce it down to the abducto, you know, absurdum of reductio ad absurdum of what is it, it is a deceptive, abusive relationship.
Yeah, that's really then what it isolates people from friends and family.
That's right.
So Scientology fits into that, many churches, and like you say, organizations like Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, the Moonies, etc., ad nauseum, ad infinitum. The exactly. list goes on. They could, that template you could put over the top of these groups and say, okay, they're a destructive cult. One of the things I was thinking about, I read an article by Dr. Marlene Winnell. She was talking about religious trauma syndrome. And she said, what religious trauma syndrome, it's kind of a double whammy. And a lot of that would fit Scientology as well, wouldn't it? That on mm-hmm. the one hand, it does induce trauma in the follower while they're in the religion for all the reasons you just outlined. But then secondly, when you leave that religion, there's another on the back end, you get traumatized additionally and further because you're shunned, you're isolated from friends, family that are still in the religion. So in Scientology, you're labeled an SP, a suppressive person, that people are told to disconnect from you. So you lose all that community, which of course is very traumatic, or potentially. So it's a double whammy. So in that respect, it's a destructive cult, as many churches and other organizations are. Would you say that sort of fits in your experience?
Absolutely. You know, we use the word destructive advisedly, right? Cults in general are not necessarily inherently good or bad. A cult is just a group of people who have pretty strong beliefs focused around a central group, and usually a charismatic leader of some kind is sort of pictured in the equation as well, as some kind of like leader-follower sort of thing. But strictly speaking, the word cult doesn't necessarily require that. But when you move up, when you start getting into the nuance of this, I stress the word destructive because we're not talking about the Boy Scouts or the Girl Scouts. You can call mm-hmm. those guys cults. You can call the military a cult. But mm-hmm. are they a destructive cult? No, they are not. Not in a general sense. Are there little destructive cults inside the military? You bet your ass there
Absolutely.
Are, right? Are there little destructive cults, say, in a Catholic, I don't know what the terminology is, a parish or a diocese or something? Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You could have You could have some local guy abusing the shit out of everybody under him, right?
Which they do.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. We see that.
And not a far stretch.
That's right. And the level of abuse, let's keep this in mind also, has to do with all those characteristics we were talking about earlier, right? You can also have outright criminals in a group doing outright criminal things. Mm. That doesn't mean the group's a cult. It means it has bad elements in it. Those bad elements have to be engaging in very specific kinds of activities, producing exact kinds of results in the followers, where there's this codependency between them. You see, just victimizing people doesn't make a group a cult. It's when there is this codependent relationship created where the followers are feeding the leader and the leader is feeding the followers. They both have needs that are being met by each other, and that is key to understanding the relationship.
It's a symbiotic relationship, however dysfunctional it might be. Well, and as you mentioned, Leah Remini, I mean, that's that series on TV, that's got to have blown a lot of the lid off of the more the destructive elements, because a lot of the episodes had to do with personal stories of horrific things that people underwent during their time as Scientologists, being locked in the hole, some of the more extreme examples. and obviously being labeled a suppressive person, being disconnected from the friends and family. I remember Mike Rinder talking about he's got children still in Scientology that he hasn't talked to in, you know, years and years because he can't, he doesn't know where they are. They won't talk to him. He can't talk to them. That's got to be brutal, painful thing for a parent to have to live with, looking at the fact that they can't communicate with their children. And of course, then there's the fair game policy, which is a whole nother deal where they will come after you. They will try and destroy your life as an official Scientology policy. If that's not a destructive cult, I don't know what is. They've destroyed people's lives. And I know they've come after you on some level, surely, haven't they?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've got a right now. You can look up if you Google my name and you go down the search list, you'll find the Scientology hate page about me, you know, where my ex-wife is trashing me on video and they tell a bunch of lies. Oh, yeah. And they literally, you know, they know everything about me. They literally monitored my activities for almost 3 decades. And yet they can't get the truth down in this. You know, character assassination webpage they created about me. They get the dates wrong and the times wrong and all kinds of things wrong. They claim I'm a this and I'm a that, and I was none of those things. But Scientology has to be the good guys, and so anybody who attacks Scientology have to be the bad guys. So they have to reframe everything in the worst possible light to make you out to be the horrible, awful criminal that you have to be for them. Because they can't believe that a non-criminal would attack Scientology. So they have to make you a criminal. And they have to tell the world about your criminal awfulness. Hmm. And that's part of their quote-unquote fair gaming. When they're not physically following you around, stalking you, harassing you, private killing your pets.
Yeah.
You know, going after, flattening your tires of your car. I mean, just a bunch of ghoulish, pranky, third grade level stuff, as well as the more legal, you know, serious legal stuff that they'll pull. Oh, yeah. So they
straight they, harassment, yeah. though, really, isn't it? But it wears exactly people down. I remember watching the Louis Theroux documentary, and you know, he talks about being followed, and you know, other documentaries I've seen on YouTube and other places where these investigators, they'll pop up across the country. How did they know they were on a flight from Los Angeles to Clearwater, Florida, or somewhere where they just pop up? You know, they're tracking these people. Well, now this is my question. Okay, given all that you've described, why would anyone join Scientology? How do they get, you know, you think, wait a minute, the word is getting out there. The message is getting through. People have seen Leah Remini. They've listened to your podcast and others. They've seen the documentaries. Why would a person get sucked in? Because you hear this a lot. I think we've talked about this before. Only stupid people get pulled into cults, Chris. Gullible fools.
Right. It's, no, of course.
Know, educated, smart people don't fall for this nonsense, but yet we find that actually it's sometimes the more educated people can get pulled into cults, and you think, wait a minute, how does this work? How does a person actually get into Scientology in terms of an average thing?
Well, it's funny, you know, because we've actually proven now that if you have an IQ over 140, you're completely immune to ever falling for a destructive cult.
Oh, of course.
Oh, yeah. That's so really, it's just if you have a high IQ, you're good.
You're good to go.
Yeah, you are absolutely cult-proof. Fine. No one could ever fool you about anything at any time. Mm. You know, you can't be lied to. Nobody could possibly stroke your ego. And no one could ever love bomb you and convince you by telling you how wonderful and amazing you are, how you might possibly, you know, be swayed to join something or be part of something, because everybody with an IQ over 140 knows in every circumstance they're ever in when they're being played, right? That's how it, that's totally how it works.
That's how it works. So we don't need to answer that question.
Yeah. So we can just move on now, right?
Yeah. I got another question for you.
Yeah. Okay, good. Now, I'm losing hair, and this is why, because I pull it out all the time because of this, right? This nonsense. People have, well, it's Dunning-Kruger effect, right? I mean, it is now scientifically proven. This is not just some conjecture on our part, that the more ignorant a person is in a particular zone or topic or area, for whatever reason, because we are the way we are and the way our brains work, and we can go into all kinds of detail we don't have to go into in this podcast. Mm. If you go, you know, look up Dunning-Kruger and you look at the studies, you'll see what I'm talking about. The bottom line is that the more ignorant you are on something, because we have this thing called an ego, the more sure you are you actually know all about it. And it's crazy. It's so counterintuitive. Nobody would fess up to this, but it's absolutely true. Mm. And the more you start learning about something, the less your certainty becomes, right? You become less sure of yourself as you actually become more and more knowledgeable about a thing. And this little piece of psychological wisdom is not lost on people who design cults and how people get into them, right? Because they play on that level of ignorance. Now, Scientology specifically is pretty past most of those trickeries at this point because they have been so exposed for the longest time through the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and even well into the 90s. There was no internet. No one had the ability to go look up Scientology and see what was what. There was very little printed about it, very little talked about it in the big wide world. A Playboy magazine interview in the 70s with L. Ron Hubbard's kid, a Reader's Digest article, various random newspaper articles, you know, that Time magazine cover story finally in what, 92 or 93, right? Like, that's it. That's all you had. And if you didn't go do your research and it required a deep level of research.
You'd have to go to a library or,
Yeah, you, just you jump weren't going to know. That's right. Now, right? And I just love saying this, so I always throw it out there every time I can. The internet has been Scientology's Vietnam. It has been the battle they cannot win. It has been the war they cannot, achieve victory in, because now people know, and there has been so much exposure about it, that now they truly are not growing. Now they really are just running on inertia. But for all those years, and I got in, remember, as a second gen, there are four levels of second gens now. You got second gen, third, fourth, even, right? Up to fourth generation Scientologists happening now. Because there's whole families that have been involved in this since the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s. So a lot of their current membership is just sort of living on that inertia. They're really not getting hardly anything in now in terms of new members. But let's not fool ourselves, right? Yeah, Scientology's failing because of all of this exposure that we've now created. But people, all that being said, people are very easy to fool, basically. Right. And I don't say like a sucker's born every minute and all that. What I'm saying something even worse. I'm saying we're all suckers. We all have a proclivity. We all have our weaknesses. We all have ways we can be told things that will convince us as to the truth of something, just because that's how our biases work. That's how we have a bent toward a thing, right? It's every single person's different on this. What works for you won't work for me. What works for me won't work for you. It's different. And when you walk into a place like Scientology, everything that you see and everything that you hear and everything that's told to you and the personality test that you take and the literature that you read and everything about that experience, it's a crafted experience. It is not an organic, just naturally happening sort of thing where you walk in and go, hey, what's up here? And they go, hey, what's up? And you just have this natural organic conversation. That's not what's going on when you walk into a Church of Scientology. It only looks like that because you don't know the hours and hours and days of drilling and practice and work that every one of these people you're seeing has been put through to make it look like this very natural process.
Yeah, seems organic
Yeah. There's all these steps that you're being led through and you're basically, you know, you're being reeled in, right?
It's a sales job. Yeah.
That's right.
I've had that happen to me. Yeah. In stores, I've walked into a store and the salesperson has zeroed in on the one thing that I really am after. And man, the next thing I know, I'm signing the paperwork for something that I...
That's right. Shut up and take my money, you know?
Yeah. And I walk out, how the hell did that just happen? I was played, as you say, because this salesperson was absolutely skilled at working. You know, they could hook me in and pull me in and figure out what my motivations were and all those sorts of things. So yeah, it's very carefully crafted. Well, that's the part of the mystical manipulation, surely, that Lifton talks about. It seems spontaneous. It seems free flowing and organic, but it's very carefully choreographed and staged in a way. Well, we used to do the same thing in evangelicalism, maybe not as insidious, but I mean, I went to evangelism training seminars. I used to teach people this stuff. You know, when you encounter someone, let's role play. Let's talk about, you know, if you ask me this, how would you respond? And you go through it. And so you're not caught off guard and you've got an answer. You've got something to say. And, you know, so we did the same sorts of things in Christianity. So anyway, so this person walks in, they're actually being played. They don't realize it, of course, but then eventually comes the indoctrination at some point, surely.
Well, yeah, it's starting from the first word. I mean, starting from the first moment, you know. And let's be clear that the reason why these groups are destructive is because they are engaged in active deception. They're not being upfront with you, right? That is part and parcel of this entire experience, is that you are, we wouldn't be talking about these groups and we wouldn't be going on a roll about them if they were honest, open groups that where informed consent was a real thing and it was practiced and it worked. If you knew everything that was going to happen to you and all of the things that were going to be expected of you as a Scientologist before you actually got all the way involved, right. You never get cars, involved,
yeah,
because you walk in on day one and they'd say, yeah, here's this bridge to total freedom. Yeah.
It's going to cost you this much money.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I know what you mean. It's going to cost.
Exactly. If they told you on day one,
you might end up in the hole. Yeah. You're going to be abused.
Well, yeah, that's right. We're going to psychologically abuse you. We're going to emotionally manipulate you. We're going to play you for your money every chance we get. Right. Not just for the services that we're going to ask you to buy or the books and lectures that we're going to ask you to buy, but also for the, you know, I'll just call them the save mankind crusade
mm-hmm.
that we're also engaged in. They use other words, but basically that's what they're doing is they're saying that they're saving the world and they're on a crusade and they need your money because money is the fuel that keeps the machine going, right? Mm-hmm. So there's always a reason in Scientology for you to be giving over all of your money. And if they told you on day one that that was what your experience of the whole thing was going to be like, you'd be like, oh, yeah, thanks, but no thanks, right? But they don't tell you anything about that. They tell you, oh, it's just a $15 course. What's the big deal?
Yeah, and you'll get to know yourself. And it's kind of a cathartic counseling session. And that's how a lot of it's billed, isn't it? It's a scientific approach to mental health without all the mumbo-jumbo of Freud and Jung and all that other nonsense. This is science, man. This is get these e-meters and it'll tell you exactly what's wrong with you and how to fix yourself. It sounds great. If it were true, it would be wonderful. We don't need all the mumbo jumbo, surely. Why can't we just grab an e-meter?
Exactly. If it were true, the world would be banging down the doors of every Scientology church in the world. And they're not, because it's not.
Yeah,
they cannot deliver anything remotely like what they promise they can deliver. At best, they give you a subjective experience where you feel a little better, you get the dopamine rush, you get the euphoria, and you know, and even that itself can become one of the control mechanisms, because then you can become addicted to it, right? And you
absolutely
want more.
You need
and
more.
Then you come back,
then it starts costing you more and more and more money, but then you're so hooked in. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Then you're on that bridge. And I think they've covered that quite well on the Leah Remini series, haven't they? How much money people have, and they don't realize over the years, a few thousand dollars or pounds or whatever currency you're dealing with, over the years, 20, 30, 40, 50, hundreds of thousands. And the person looks back and says, oh my God, I gave them $100,000 over the course
That's
of
right.
20, 25 years. What the hell?
That's
Where's
right.
all that money gone? Never and, get it back.
And, that's right. And even sometimes while you're in, you're still counting the pennies and going, my God, I'm giving over all this money. But they give you enough. It is so similar to a drug dealer, right?
Right,
it's so similar. Like you keep coming back because you need that hit. You need that euphoria. You need that feel good, right? And the cult leader or the subject, you know, Scientology itself, starts acting like that. That, you know, they're going to give you another hit. They're going to give you another hit. But every time it's shorter lasting, it's more expensive, and they're leading you on. And then they're promising you the next hit's going to be the one that's going to do it for you. It's going to blow your mind, right? And you just keep hoping and keep hoping because there's sunk cost fallacy. There's appeal to authority. There's appeal to emotion. Yeah. I mean, the logical fallacies just pile one on top of another.
Yeah. But it makes sense, though, because, again, I can relate that to my own experience. You keep going to church every Sunday. You're a wretched sinner. God's going to help you. You've got this wonderful worship service. You're revved up for Jesus, man. You're fired up by the inspiring music, and the sermon is over the top. And, yes, you're on a cloud. But then by Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you're back in the shit again, and you got to go back and get that hit. So it's a similar sort of gateway drug sort of thing that within Christianity and other religions, obviously, it's not just unique to Scientology. Well, that's my last question. I'm curious to find out, as you come out of Scientology, we've kind of overviewed this whole thing and said, yeah, that the psychology is very, very similar group to group to group. How do you reconstruct? Because you mentioned that a lot of it is when you get out, you're so angry. You're lashing out. You're on the forums. You're on the chat rooms. You're on Facebook, and you're, you know, ranting and raving. We see it in every culture: Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, ex-evangelicals, ex-Scientologists. But then, what happens? You can't live on that rage forever, or can you? How do you rebuild? How do you reconstruct? What's your advice for someone who's trying to take back their life and put it all back together?
Yeah, this is the toughest part because it's so context specific and individual to each person, but we have our stages, right? I mean, you have these, you know, so-called stages of grief, and that's not universal, by the way, folks. Not everybody goes through that in the same way. But when you actually dig into the details, you find out that's not how it's posited. It's not like everybody's supposed to even go through all these stages in the same way. For me, it's all been about education. It's been about understanding the process of what happened to me. And that has enabled me to crawl out of the pit of despair and anger and betrayal that I very definitely was thrown in. I mean, I don't look at this as this was all my fault. However, now that I've had a little bit more time and distance from the whole thing, I have been able to look back and see where things were my fault. And where I was the one who was contributing and making things happen. But I would never start pointing stuff like that out to somebody on day one or day two of their recovery. You have to experience the rage. You have to experience the betrayal. You have to experience the loss. And it is a loss. It's a huge loss. It's a gigantic loss.
It is.
People don't process it that way. They tend to throw it in the closet, to ignore it. I'm not going to think about that anymore. No, you should think about it. You should get through the process. Mm. Not obsess over it, right? And again, these are all like, okay, so everybody's going to be a little different about this. Everybody's involvement with their group was a little bit different. So disentangling the process is really a matter, for me, the best way I've come to describe it is it's been a process of disentangling the causative elements of the experience. You know, I suffered PTSD. I had nightmares for years, right? I still do. They still pop up from time to time, but not anywhere near as much as they used to. You have emotional components to this. You have, I mean, up until just last year, this save the world motivation I was talking about was driving me hard. All the way up until this last year when it really presented itself as, oh, I need to look at this now. This has not been something I've had a lifelong ambition to do. This was instilled in me. This was installed in me as a goal. And it's not like I now don't want to help people or I don't want to make the world a better place, but I've had to process, what does it mean to save the world? What is that? What are we talking about? Can you save the world? Does the world even want to be saved? Is that something I should even be working on? Did Jesus even pull that off? Well, shit, if he didn't, what makes me think I can? I mean, what are we talking about here, right? Mm. Really deconstructing these things, that takes time. It takes, unfortunately, way more time than you think it will. or that you think it should. Mm. And, you know, and I've been very actively working on my recovery over these last years. And I know on a part-time basis, it's going to be even tougher for people. So I can only offer broad strokes of get educated on what happened to you. Watch podcasts like these, read my book, read other people's books. There's a lot of good stuff out there from members, from former members of all of these groups that, you know, that you can partake in or take a look at. So education, counseling, you know, have a person, have somebody, have a group, have a support network, create one if you don't have one. I know it's easier said than done. I definitely realize that. I've had to create mine own over the years. I know. But give yourself also the time to do all these things. One of the things that goes on in these groups, and this is one of the little traps that they install in you, is that we are running out of time. Time is a huge control element in these destructive cults. You are always kept at a frantic pace of, there's always an emergency. There's always something to be freaking out about. And all your attention is on that. And then it's not on what the cult leader is doing. It's not on the money that's being embezzled. It's not on you being taken advantage of. It's on this freak out emergency that we have to, you know, save the world. We have to do this. We have to do this.
Go.
That's right. Whatever
Thunderbirds go, whatever.
That's right. That's right. And it's a created thing. That's not an accident that your head is in that space all the time, right? It can become a bad habit though. And when you come out of these groups and you're back into the big wide world, you got to remember to slow the hell down, take a breath, realize that the only one who's creating that franticness now is you. It's in your head, and you can chill that out because it's not an accurate reflection of the real world and the demands that the real world is making on you. It's a shadow talking to you. It's this cult leader talking to you in your head. So that itself can even be a trap. I'm not fixed fast enough. I'm still bugged over this. Yeah, and it's been struggling. Like a month or two, you know, it's been a year
years.
And there's still, you're still thinking about
they're
it.
Freaking
like,
out.
What you expect, you know, you were in it for 25 years. Just how long did you think it was going to take to recover? Try 25 years,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Like it's going to take whatever it's going to take. So you got to lower the pressure and the expectations on yourself too. That's really key. And I don't know that I've ever stressed that part before in talking about this. Yeah. Cause I ran that on myself so hard. I had such high expectations for myself. I told myself when I first got out, I told my friends when I first started my YouTube channel, I said, if I'm still making videos about Scientology a year from now, shoot me. Well, a year passed and I had barely begun to dent the armor of my cult personality. And I started realizing after a year, oh shit. Just this is gonna take a
tip
while.
Of the iceberg. Luckily, none of your friends had guns. Hopefully, you are in America though, so you know you got to be careful. Well, that's the thing. I was thinking too what you said earlier about we don't like to admit that we've been manipulated, used, abused, that we were pawns in a bigger scheme. That's something that's really struck me in the last 6 or 8 months. Obviously, we've talked about Dominion theology, Christian Reconstructionism on your podcast, and even what's going on politically within evangelicalism and the Trump era and all the rest of it. But I was a part of that movement as a kid growing up in this context. And I look back on that now and I think, my God, there were massive forces that I was totally unaware of that put me in a context and led me down this certain path that I thought I was directing my own steps, as it were. I was going to Bible college. I was going to seminary. I was doing all these things for me, but I wasn't. I was living out someone else's agenda. Bigger forces were at play. And now I look back and think, my God, I mean, I was part of a movement. I was part of a thing. And I disavow all that now. And that's part of why, kind of like you, I want to get the word out, let people know about what is going on in these worlds to raise awareness, to educate people. So that's a huge factor. So I'm glad that you're doing what you're doing, and I'll keep doing what I'm doing. So we'll circle back around for sure. I was going to say too, speaking of communities, we talked a little bit before we hit the record button. One of the ways that is a good way to get in touch with Chris is looking up the Sensibly Speaking podcast. What other ways can people get a hold of you on social media?
Oh, yeah. I have a Facebook page, Critical Thinker at Large. It's, so you can find me on Facebook under Critical Thinker at Large. That's my professional page, so to speak. So go check that out. I post all my non... I have a podcast where I do the Sensibly Speaking podcast. That has its own Facebook page. And then I have my Critical Thinker at Large page, which I post, you know, stuff all the time. And videos. I post videos every day of the week, actually, because I have a clips channel where I post little clips and snippets from my work. So I'm constantly putting work out there. You can look me up by my name on YouTube, Chris Shelton. If you Google Chris Shelton Scientology, all my stuff comes up.
It's all there. And I see your stuff quite a bit on the, it's the Cult Survivors Network on Facebook. And yes. That's the name of the group. And Chris posts a lot of things on there. I'll occasionally post things on there as well. That's an ever-growing community. So if you're an ex-religious person, ex-cult member, that's another good port of call, isn't it, to find out what's going on. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for being on the show. I think we've talked a little bit about you being a guest on our Mindshift Zoom call. So that's another way maybe to get to know Chris a little bit. If you're a supporter of this show on Patreon, we do monthly Zoom calls with our group. We just had one the other day. It was amazing. We have a lot of ex or former guests on the show. So at some point we'll get Chris back on there on a Sunday. So yeah, thank you so much, Chris. I've absolutely enjoyed talking to you once again. Thank you for being a guest here on Mindshift Podcast.
Awesome, man. Thank you very much for having me and giving me the opportunity to